So, what did everyone bring today to this meal?
An appetite,
exactly, right? What do we ever bring to the table when we spend time with God? It's just an appetite, right? We have nothing to provide, and it's all provided for us. And all we can bring is our appetite and our gratitude. And so I hope this is just an opportunity to do that, bring our appetite for God's word and bring gratitude as a result. So Deuteronomy is actually, even though we have a Hebrew Old Testament, Deuteronomy is a Greek word. It means a second law or a second giving of law. And that can be an automatic shut off to some people. I wanted to throw a little question out there. And I'd like to get responses as they pop off your head. Okay, so don't digest it too much. So I want an honest answer. When you hear the word law, when it comes to the Bible, what's the first word that pops to your mind? Say them loud so I can write them really, really bad handwriting. Teaching, okay.
Punishment.
Okay. Going?
Ten Commandments.
Ten Commandments. Okay. Okay. Good. Keep going. I like this.
Bryce.
One more time.
Bryce.
Bryce?
You're the police officer.
Okay, I'm going to leave that one off for now. Sorry.
Protection.
What was that?
Protection.
Protection? Good. Okay. Any others? Sorry.
Good.
I like the range I'm hearing so far here. Any others?
Love.
Any others?
Boundaries.
Great.
Covenant.
Very good. We'll get into that one.
Mike, I figure these people are all way too well taught to
say yeah. Bad, okay, good.
Or opposite of grace.
Opposite of grace.
But these folks are so saturated in the whole Bible.
That's good. That's what I want, yeah. All right, so we got a little range here. I'm going to say a little more on the, like Ryan said there, on the maybe negative aspects of the law. Sometimes we have a range of punishment. It's not that it's a bad thing. It's what results from breaking the law, right? So the negative aspect, punishment. Maybe rules might be construed as a negative thing. We don't like people telling us what to do for the most part, since we're people. Standards, maybe. Restrictive. Obedience. Oh boy, everyone loves to obey, right? Boundaries. Bad, opposite of grace. So we got kind of that's that one end of the spectrum. And the right answers, the Sunday school answers, right, are all the more positive leaning understanding of law. Teaching, Moses being the lawgiver or the law mediator. Ten Commandments being specific to it. Holy, making the people holy through it. Protections. It is good. It's a safety for people. It promotes love. And it's part of the covenant with God. So we have a little range. And my question is, how close to... Have you guys read Psalm 119 enough times? A lot of times. When you read it, the language throughout is this meditation on what the law of the Lord is. And over again, The law of the Lord is good. It's life-giving. All the things that it says about it, would it end up on that board if you were to be honest with yourself? Like how you perceive God's laws, God's rules for you. And that's just a meditative question as we go. What I wanted to bring out is the reason that the law is so good. And as we get into Deuteronomy here, this is going to come out. You're not left guessing. So if you remember the book of Job, everything goes wrong in his life. He does everything right. He's called blameless. And yet everything goes wrong. And he and his friends are left guessing, why? What did I do? What thing did I do? What thing did I say? Whatever it was, what was it that made this outcome? Because obviously this outcome has to have been because I did something wrong, right? And most of the world at this time of the law giving from Moses, most of the world at this time was in that process of guessing. I wanted to read a little excerpt from a Sumer prayer. It is a non-Israelite, it's not from us, but it will bring out this guessing game very, very clearly at what did I do and what God is mad at me. Because this was the situation that most of these people were in. This is just a little piece of it. May the wrath of the heart of my God be pacified. May the God who is unknown to me be pacified. May the goddess who is unknown to me be pacified. May the known and unknown God be pacified. Covering all our bases here, right? May the known and unknown goddess be pacified. The sin which I have committed, I know not. The misdeed which I have committed, I know not. Not trying to figure out what I did wrong, right? Just confess even these things I don't even know, right? A gracious name may my God announce. A gracious name may my goddess announce. A gracious name may my known and unknown God announce. A gracious name may my known and unknown goddess announce. Pure food have I not eaten. Clear water have I not drunk. Still trying to figure out what in the world I did wrong. An offense against my God I have unwittingly committed. A transgression against my goddess I have unwittingly committed. O Lord, my sins are great. My iniquities are many. My God, my sins are many. My greater are my iniquities. The sin which I have committed, I know not. The iniquity which I have done, I know not. And this goes on and on and on as this prayer continues. And it's pretty long. And that's exactly the situation that the law comes into, where you're no longer left guessing. Yahweh is extremely explicit at what he loves and what he hates, and what he expects people to emulate him, to be like him. He lays it all out. He gives it to them. And this is the reason that the psalmist can then write in Psalm 118, and then I think Ryan was mentioned too, Psalm 1, meditating on the law day and night. That's the setting that this book comes into, that God steps in and gets rid of this guessing game, and he lays it all out. And then we're left, like Micah says, you know what the Lord expects of you, to do justly, to love mercy, to walk humbly before your God. And that's really a quotation right out of the heart of Deuteronomy, saying the same thing over and over again, that you know what Yahweh expects of you because he laid it out. Moses says, I think in chapter 29, that the hidden things belong to the Lord, but the things that are revealed belong to you and to your children. In other words, he's given you all you need to know for, like Peter says, for life and godliness. And the guessing game's gone. So that's really the beauty of the law of Yahweh. And I think a lot of times we come into that with maybe our understanding of the law, as in speed limit or stop signs or seatbelt or you know, you name it, the million laws that we have that we tabulate. And it's not about that. Those are all there for our safety. And same thing for all of Yahweh's laws are there for our safety, for our good, for creating holiness, for giving protection to society, for creating safety and promoting love, and all those things down there that were the positive aspects. That's why the law is given. Does that make sense? So Deuteronomy itself is the fifth of the books of the Torah, the law. And basically, it's so up to this point, we have the story of Abraham taken out of Ur of the Chaldeans, brought to the land of Canaan, promised that land, promised to his descendants. Abraham has Isaac. Isaac has Jacob. And Jacob has the 12 tribes of Israel that end up down in Egypt. 300 years they stay down there. They end up in slavery. And at the end of all that, Yahweh rescues them out of there. Now they went from 70 people when they went down to 3 million people between that time. And pulls them out of Egypt. And he gives them his law, his covenant at Mount Sinai out in the wilderness. Immediately they rebelled. And they built the golden calf and da-da-da. That ended up in 40 years of wandering around the wilderness. That whole generation died off. And now we're left with a completely new generation. So 40 years later, these are the children of that parent generation. That parent generation is the one that saw the rescue from Egypt. It's that parent generation that was there at Mount Sinai and heard the voice of Yahweh and saw Moses come down from there with the radiance. It was that parent generation. And now we have this risk, just as we do today, of falling in line with the faith of the fathers and not owning it. And so this message of Deuteronomy is Moses about to send the people across the Jordan River to now go inherit Canaan, as was promised, but it's to a completely new generation. And so he's retelling this story in the first 11 chapters of the book. He's retelling this story so they remember, because they weren't necessarily part of that. They're the younger generation. He is reminding them of who Yahweh is, what he's done, and what he's about to do, that he's the one that's giving this land to them. 34 times, I think, or 36 times in the book, it says, this is the land that the Lord, that Yahweh, is giving to you. Again, reiterating over and over again, this is not your work. This is not you that's about to go in and do this. Yahweh is going before you to go and conquer this land. And you happen to be the servant that follows that master. So kind of that little brief synopsis. After the Exodus and 40 years, this is just right off the little worksheet I handed out. After the Exodus and 40 years of wandering in the wilderness, just before Israel crosses the Jordan River to take the land inheritance, renews the Sinai covenant with this new generation, reminding them of Yahweh's providence and presence with them, of the love they must return to him for his providence, and of the consequences that they and their descendants will face if they fail to stay loyal to him as their master. And so throughout this book is this forecasting of a future apostasy, a future turning away from Yahweh, and then what's going to happen as a result, that it doesn't end that way, that he's always there, he's always waiting for their return to him. So when, a little pop quiz here, when in Matthew, when Jesus is being tempted by Satan in the wilderness, three times he quotes scripture. The first time, what book is that from? Deuteronomy. Second time, where's it from? There's a theme here. Yeah, Deuteronomy. Third time, where's it from? Deuteronomy. Okay. So what was this? What was the preeminent book that's in his head in the middle of temptation? All right, Deuteronomy. And so don't think of Deuteronomy as dull and dry, because this was the heart of the law of God. This was the climax of those first five books of the Bible. And this is the heart that then goes into the prophets. It's the same themes over and over throughout the prophets that Jesus is in line of too, as a prophet, and now speaking as one of these prophets too. It's a very, very heartfelt, emotional response to Yahweh, not a dry, dull following of ordinances and commands. Throughout this book, over and over again, there's this pairing of listen, hear, O Israel, and love. That those two go together throughout the book. Listening, not just sounds coming to your head and into your ears, but actually letting it sink in and then doing something about it, responding back in love. That's our fidelity, our loyalty to him in the covenant. So some of the key texts, like I mentioned, the ones that that Jesus quotes three times there, but some of the key texts in there that we all recognize, the Ten Commandments in chapter 5. So it's a rehashing again. This is 40 years later, and he's re-giving this law to this new generation. It's a rehashing of the Ten Commandments in chapter 5. In chapter 6, we have a very famous passage as well. I'm actually going to read that one because it's one of the hearts, it's kind of the heart of the book. Go to chapter 6 of Deuteronomy if you got your Bible in front of you. This is called the Shema because in Hebrew that's the first word, Shema Yisrael, and it goes from there. Chapter 6, verse 4. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your might. And these words that I command you today shall be on your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children, shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, and when you rise. Shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes. You shall write them on your doorposts of your house and on your gates. And when the Lord your God brings you into the land he swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give you, with great and good cities that you didn't build, and houses full of all good things that you didn't fill, and cisterns that you didn't dig, and vineyards and olive trees that you didn't plant. And when you eat and are full, and then take care, lest you forget the Lord who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. It's the Lord your God you shall fear. Him you shall serve, and by his name you shall swear. You shall not go after other gods, the gods of the peoples who are around you. For the Lord your God in your midst is a jealous God, lest the anger of the Lord your God be kindled against you, and he destroy you from off the face of the earth. So that is the Shema. It's a very, very dynamic beginning of one of the three sermons that Moses gives right there right as they are about to cross over the Jordan River. And it's a reminder, again, like I said, of this the past events, what Yahweh has done, what he is now with them, and what he's about to do in the future with them as well. Some of the other key texts in there, in chapter 32, is something called the Song of Moses. And the Song of Moses is actually like a poetic retelling of the whole book of Deuteronomy. The book of Deuteronomy mirrors what's called a covenant renewal. So in ancient setting, you have a servant and a master that the servant swears fidelity to a master. And there are these parts of this covenant that would be written down, and you would get one copy for the servant, and one copy would go to the master. So we have two tablets that the law were written on, right? One copy goes to the servant, Israel, and one copy goes to the master, Yahweh. And they are both deposited in the Ark of the Covenant. But that's the point of the two tablets, two copies of the same covenant. And this is again, 40 years later, a rehashing and a renewal of this covenant. And the whole book of Deuteronomy fits around this exact framework that an ancient covenant renewal form would look like. And then Deuteronomy 32, this Song of Moses, is actually a lawsuit against Israel for breaking that covenant. And then it ends with them going into exile. This is Moses foretelling them going into exile, and then not just leaving it there, but what's going to happen afterward, that Yahweh restores them, and then there's this promise of something greater. And we see it a few times in this book, that we're broken, our hearts don't work the way that they need to, and he needs to renew them. And he's going to, what he says in Deuteronomy, circumcise the heart. Not just a covenant made in the flesh, but one made in the inmost being that's going to bind them to Yahweh. And we know what that is. We know that's the new covenant through Jesus, right? But this is that foretelling towards something greater, something that's going to make us actually be able to obey this law and love it the way that we need to. So a few initial questions in the book. I actually already answered one of those, but what kind of book is it? I already mentioned it's that a covenant renewal. That's the form. The servant, Israel, the master, Yahweh. This is on that little worksheet. The covenant witnesses. That's a very, very interesting one. Covenant witnesses are normally like elders in a community or something like that. The covenant witnesses that Moses calls are heaven and earth. And he calls it several times throughout the several times throughout the book that he's calling heaven and earth as the witness against Israel. And then in the Song of Moses, those are the witnesses. It then states the benevolence of the master, the things that he did, the things that he's done up to this point. And then the servant's due response to that master's benevolence. That is the law code that we see from chapter 7 through 25, which has all the kind of rehashing of the law. And then at the end, this the vowing of loyalty to the covenant. And then in chapters 28 and 29, we have this listing of all the blessings that come from the following of the covenant and the curses that will follow from not following that covenant. And they're very explicit. And some of them are almost word for word exactly what happened to Israel as Jerusalem is conquered later, 1,000 years later. Another big question, who wrote Deuteronomy? Easiest question is Moses. He wrote the vast majority of the book. He wrote all the sermons, obviously. He wrote the law codes that we mentioned from chapter 6 to 25. He wrote the Song of Moses. He wrote the blessings of the tribes. That's 99% of the book. There is content in there that you'd be like, how did Moses write about his own death? Like if you read in chapter 34, it tells the story of Moses' death. So how does Moses write his own death? So he probably didn't write that part of it, right? Unless he was forecasting that as well. And then right after that, the very last paragraph of the book, it says, and since then, there has never been a prophet like Moses in Israel. So this is a little after him, right? The very beginning of the book says these are the words that Moses spoke on the other side of the Jordan. Moses never crossed the Jordan, so he didn't write from there. So the compiler of the book who put all of Moses' words together is writing from either during or after the conquest of Canaan. But very same time frame. If you look at how the books of Deuteronomy, Joshua, Judges, Samuel, and Kings all go together, the writers dovetailed them to each other. Deuteronomy ends with the death of Moses. Joshua picks up mentioning the death of Moses. Joshua ends with the death of Joshua. Judges picks up with the death of Joshua. Judges ends saying there was no king at that time, and everyone did what was right in their own eyes. And then the books of Samuel and Kings start out with the birth of Samuel, who anointed the first of the kings and started the monarchy, right? So there's this big story, the big history of Israel that's being started in the book of Deuteronomy that later would be piled onto throughout the years. So it's the first, the capstone, or maybe. The structure of Deuteronomy, go ahead and look at your little worksheet of the Bible Project. This is a beautiful little diagram. Does everyone have one? I don't know if you guys think in these type of, if this is how your brain works, But there's a lot.
I print off more.
Does anyone need these? Yeah, that's right. This is a kind of a picture breakdown of what the book of Deuteronomy is about. And it'll tell the chapters up there, what happens in each section. And the amount of work that went into this, the Bible Project, is absolutely incredible. This is, I can't state enough how incredible this this project is. And we all need to be spending time with this. If you want a little 6 or 7 minute kind of digestion of a book of the Bible and an accurate one, they have one for every single book of the Bible, and it's phenomenal the work that's put into it. So this is a really good telling of how it breaks down the structure of the book. Moses' opening speeches from the first 11 chapters, and then from 12 to 26, like we mentioned, those law codes, those are broken down roughly into 5 different sections. Religious observances, and if you look on my worksheet that I handed out, religious observances has to do with like sacrifices and first fruits and tithes and all the stuff that that were prescribed to the people. And you'll see in there a repeated theme of pointing toward Jerusalem as, and the temple in Jerusalem as the central place of worship. Over and over and over again, it says, the place where I'm going to cause my name to dwell. The place where I'm going to cause my name to dwell. And I think there's like, mentioned on there. 12 times. 12 times total, it says exactly the same thing. The place I'm going to cause my name to dwell. Anytime a sacrifice was offered, it had to be in that place. So they couldn't do it on the high places like all the Canaanites did. It was a centralizing of worship. And yeah, it was pointing toward this temple. Laws of retaliation. Eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth mentality. We look at that as archaic, as maybe brutal. But if you look at this next to the law codes of other areas around them, like is laid out here on that map, the Code of Hammurabi, a few other ones that are in that same time frame. This is the eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth is saying not a life for an eye. You get an eye for an eye. So it's a limiting of the amount of retaliation that could be involved in someone wronging you. You don't get to up the ante each time. There's an even plane, I guess, is a good way to think of it. Laws on marriage. Again, same thing. If you look at this from our perspective, you might be like, what in the world? Because one of them is about plunder in war and pillaging, you find a woman when they're conquesting, you know, that you want to marry. Here's the process that you go about doing that. What it's doing, if you look again at the practices of the societies around them, of the mass, like what would go on in war, I don't need to explain too much, obviously, but that was limited. And a Jew would have to give that person 30 days to grieve their past life, their family and everything, before he could marry her. Not just go and do whatever he wanted and take whatever he wanted. It was a limiting of power when you compare it to like the standard practices around him. So it's a very important thing. That's why they mentioned it on that little map there. That's how we need to be thinking about this law, that it is limiting the power that everybody else was abusing in society around them. Protecting the weak is that very next thing, right? This from chapters 23 and 20 to 25 is limiting the power of the powerful for the benefit of the weak. And how much do we need to remember that in our society too? In our own, like, what I have that I could give does not mean that it belongs, what I have that I make does not mean it belongs to me. And some of the examples of there, you have a vineyard. You gather from your vineyard, and whatever you miss, you have to leave behind. It doesn't matter that it's your field. It doesn't matter that you planted the vines. It doesn't matter any of that stuff. You leave it behind so that the poor can come through behind you and pick up what's left. If you're harvesting in a wheat field and you miss some stuff, you're not allowed to go back behind and grab what you missed. Doesn't matter how much you drop. You don't get to go behind. It's your field. You planted the crop. Doesn't matter. You keep going harvesting, and the poor come behind you. An orchard, same thing. Everything that you do is this provision for the poor behind you. So if you have a lot, then you have a lot you can give. And that same mentality then goes, we see that in the teachings of Jesus, right? Like all over the place. This limiting of our own power and our feeling of entitlement in order to give to those that don't have. And kind of last section is, like I mentioned, that covenant renewal, where he lays out in chapters 27 and 28 the blessings and the curses. Physically, what happened when they passed over the Jordan, the entire nation went through. Six of the tribes had representatives on one mountain or hill on one side, and six of the tribes had representatives on another. And one would pronounce blessings, all these blessings to the people. And the other one, they've been pronouncing these curses to the people. These are the things that are going to happen if you trespass. These are the things that are going to happen if you follow the laws. And as they passed through these, between these mountains, the people said amen as these curses and these blessings were performed, saying, yes, we agree to these. Yes, we agree. And very, very interesting when you think about like that it was very involved as a community. It wasn't Moses deciding this for his people. It was either you. Moses even says this at the very end, before he's about to die. There's two paths you guys have to choose. We're about to cross the Jordan, all in one path. But in your minds, in your hearts, there are two paths ahead of you. You are either going to follow Yahweh, or you're going to follow everything else. There's no both. And so he's setting these two paths ahead of them across the one path, across the Jordan, as they go into Canaan, and leaves it to them to choose. And he leaves it off saying, I know already that you guys are going to transgress. I know already that all these laws you're not going to hold. And that as a result, you're going to find all these curses that were promised to you. You're going to end up in another land and not have your own place. You're going to be surrounded by people that serve gods of stone and wood, is what he says. You're going to be left in that situation. And he leaves it off, and I'm going to kind of leave it off here for a couple of comments and questions. Leaves off the book with this promise of a hope there. So physically he's at the Jordan, they're about to pass in, and he's saying, this is what's ahead. This is what you guys are about to do. It's going to end in this horrible situation of exile, but that's not the end of it. That Yahweh is going to restore you when you turn back to him. And then this promise of, like I mentioned, the circumcised heart, this promise that we're not going to be left in the situation that we're in. It's not about my failure, my success. It's about Yahweh and his covenant love. Whether we're faithful to the covenant or not, he's faithful always, and is always waiting for us to return, like the prodigal son, right? This waiting, watching down the driveway for his son to return. A very, very good message of hope. Now, this message comes to us in a society that 60 or 70 years ago, I would say, had a general Judeo-Christian background. Whether everyone was following everything or not, that's not the point. We have a tendency as Christians of following in, how do we say it? God has children. God doesn't have grandchildren. So you don't get to, as the child of a child of God, that it's not enough. You have to own the faith of your fathers. And that's what makes you the child of God, not the grandchild of God. And here we are in this almost identical setting, that we are faced with the same consequences as a society, and we, as children of this covenant with God, we are responsible for responding the way that responding in a way of love back to Him as He loved us. Right? It's not about following in the letting your parents believe for you. It's not possible, right? Your spiritual parents, physical parents, doesn't matter. They can't believe for you. This has to be something that we, our own generation, this new generation, all of us here, we have to own. And that's all I got.
We'll just open it up, friends, for just a few short minutes of questions about Deuteronomy. Maybe for Micah here, what questions do you have? What questions does this raise for you? I have a question for you. Here we are in not in the Old Covenant under Moses, right? But this is still our book. We're under the New Covenant with Jesus. How should that shape the way we read this book in particular?
The context of love and faithfulness of the book of Deuteronomy plays over very, very well into New Testament theology. And that's why Jesus quotes it. That's why Paul does when he says, you know, this word isn't, it's not far from us that someone needs to go up to heaven and pull it down, or down to the depths of the sea to pull it up. It's near to you. It's within your own heart is what Deuteronomy says. And that's what Paul is quoting too. This is something that is central to our emotional seat, our heart. And so there's nothing, I don't think that's a change in New Testament theology our response. Like it's John says, that we love because God loved us, right? It's this mirroring back of love for God. And that, I think that is a good play over.
Yeah, so there are the themes, the priorities of Deuteronomy are priorities for us as well, because it's the same God yesterday, today, and forever, right? So those priorities of obedience and of love and of justice to one another, like those aren't abrogated in the New Testament. Those aren't done away with. Those are actually empowered in the New Testament. And so there's a lot of continuity for us. This book is for us. I think another way that we can think about this, and I keep wanting to call you Isaac. We have all these prophetic little names here, Isaac and Micah. What Micah's mentioned, friends, is that this book is also it's prophetic in the sense that it foreshadows what's going to come, doesn't it? So in one sense, this book was very much for that generation and for the generations ahead as they're entering into the land and they're renewing this covenant. But there's another sense in which this is just foreshadowing, and there's this promise fulfillment relationship between the giving of the law, and even the foreshadowing of the breaking of the law, and this promise for new hearts, circumcised hearts being given. And so as we look at Deuteronomy, it's for us, but it's also kind of foreshadowing us. And what we have in the giving of the Spirit and the new heart and the heart of stone being taken out. And so there's a promise fulfillment relationship here between Deuteronomy as well. Spark, any other thoughts, any other relationship that the Christian ought to have? Okay, any other questions you have for Micah on Deuteronomy as you maybe dive into it this week with a new framework, a new lens for it?
I would say it's all scripture is given for our education.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
New Testament, Old Testament, everything.
Yes. Yes. That's for us. It's for us. Very good.